Kia ora, my name's Jess Ducey, they or she pronouns. We are currently at 106 Courtney Place, which is the Urban Dream Brokerage pop-up space that we are using as Queer AF, Queer Arts Festival headquarters for this week.
Queer AF, tell me about that. Where did it come from? What is it?
Stands for Queer Arts Festival. Not the most creative title, actually. We were calling it the Queer Arts Festival for a while, and then we realized that it shortened quite nicely to Queer AF, which brought us great joy. The end of last year, my partner and I were on a road trip. I just got rejected for a job programming a festival. I really enjoy events. They really enjoy queer art. We both enjoy queer art. And we kind of started talking about how it would be neat to have just a whole festival of queer art. There's so many amazing performers and artists and writers and poets in this town, and they're doing a lot of amazing art, less so in the last couple of years. And we thought it would just be nice to have a week, just a party, basically, of as much queer art as we could get crammed into 1 week. And then we accidentally followed through on that, I guess, is how we got here. We put in for funding to Wellington City Council's Creative Communities Fund, and that came through in March. And that was kind of the impetus to go from, okay, this is a harebrained scheme, oh, okay, we can actually do this with some funding, because we'd kind of devised a model where we'd recruit producers from different art forms to put on an event kind of within their art form. We'd pay artists a base fee coming out of the subsidized, like the grants budgets and stuff, with ticket sales kind of topping that up to make sure we could pay artists, because currently at the way we price tickets and the size of venues, especially if you have to space people out under COVID, you can't pay people a fair wage based on ticket sales alone. So we needed some grant funding. And once we secured some of that, we decided to go ahead and do it.
I'm just kind of going like, wow, because community events I've known about in the past, that they've been like umbrella organisations where groups have kind of come under that umbrella. But you're actually doing more than that. You're actually paying performers, yeah?
So we made a little kind of umbrella organization. We're operating under an organization called Open Collective, which basically operates as either a charitable trust or a society without you having to do the registration. So we could run a kind of pilot that way. We both have worked in nonprofits. We've worked in fundraising. We've worked in the arts. And we know that it's really hard to make a living in the arts. I have a cushy public service day job that I cut my hours on to work on this. And it was just one of those things where we're like, no, if we're going to do events and festivals, this is about celebrating the artists, it's about creating work for them, and this is about this being a positive experience for artists. And then as a nice bonus, sharing the art with the town, and kind of showing people this is who makes this city interesting, and this is what makes Wellington a creative capital and a absolutely positively Wellington and all the kind of things that we tell ourselves about our city. And I think it's really easy to forget that those are actual people who make that. That's why this city is interesting. And we're starting to lose people because you can't afford to live in this town. And so we wanted to create some work, and basically just have a big gay party.
So can you give me a sense of some of the acts that have performed over the last week?
We've had a whole bunch of shows. We started with an opening gala on Monday, where the Tifas performed, who are Wellington's Takatapui drag troupe. They were amazing. We had some comedy and some improv on Tuesday night. Wednesday night we had a literature reading where writers read letters to their queer idols, and then we had a music gig. Thursday night we had burlesque and some poetry readings. Friday night and all week long we had Too Much Hair, a gender euphoric musical about by and about trans and non-binary and gender non-conforming people and the kind of experiences of gender euphoria. Today, Saturday is what today is, we have a circus show this evening, and then another poetry and pie, poetry and like food as a love language event later tonight. And then tomorrow there is a drag brunch. A drag high tea. Too early for brunch. 3 p.m. And all week long over at QT Hotel, we've had drag performers singing in the lounge at happy hour. And then we've had a few partner events with, there's a show on tonight at Ivy done by Rachel Atlas. That's a cabaret from people who work in or have worked in the sex work industry. And then tomorrow night is Mixed Capital Drag Finals over at Ivy, as well as a dance party, Viva Viva. And so, yeah, it's been a lot. Basically all the art forms, the only one I feel like we're kind of missing is dance, in like a pure dance sense. And I think that's because with a couple months notice, venues where you can do dance are a little bit harder to book. But we've got visual art here in the headquarters, and yeah, we're pretty stoked with the kind of array and just the coverage across the genres that we've seen, and just a nice reminder that there are beautiful queer artists in all sectors.
This is an amazing space, this hub. You've got artwork all throughout. Can you describe some of it?
Gosh, I can try. So we've got some illustrations from a member of the Glamophones who was illustrated what I believe is a number of people from the choir over the years. Some kind of pen and ink portraits, a couple of large format paintings, and I think there's some pastels and oils in there, some like illustrations, some zines. We've got some soapstone carvings, some kind of collage work, just a really nice variety, which was a really pleasant surprise to have people kind of come through. We just put an open call that was like, hey, we have a space. If you'd like to display anything, get in touch. And yeah, as expected, queer artists came through.
And it's so diverse as well. I mean, there are so many kind of mediums and ideas and visuals.
Yeah, I think it's this has been kind of a good exercise and something across the festival we want to have, is this is about celebrating queer art and queer artists, and your art doesn't have to be like explicitly queer. And I think that's something that's been interesting for some of the art forms. For instance, the circus show sold out quite quickly and has been really popular. And we've realized that it's likely because there are a lot of circus performers who are queer, but circus as an art form isn't always queer. And there's not always chances to kind of bring your whole identity to your art form. And so that's been interesting to see, and give people space to kind of be like, yes, I'm out and proud, and this is also the art I do. And some people's art is explicitly queer. Some people's art is queer just because they are.
So you're using the word queer in a whole lot of ways, and it's even in the title of the festival. Why that word?
Honestly, because it's easier and shorter than trying to kind of cover the range of identities. I personally like the word because it has left space for me, for my identity to kind of evolve and change, and it captures a lot of stuff that's around both your sexual orientation and also your gender identity and your expression and the way you move in the world. And I personally enjoy the word because it leaves space for things to change. It's a really kind of nice catch-all for a community without having to come up with the exact words that describe how I feel about my gender and my sexuality, which honestly, I'm not sure how I do. Ask me in a week, I might have a different word for it. And so we like the word for that because it is a nice catch-all. We enjoy that it's kind of been and is being reclaimed from having been a slur. And it's just a lovely, it's a nice word that kind of says, that implies a lot of things about the way you see the world and the way you move through the world without having to define it more than that, and gives people space to kind of name their own identities. Yeah.
How do you think it influences, one, the people that are coming to you in terms of they've got performances, productions they want to do, but also the audiences when they see something like queer in the title? Does that influence who comes to the performances?
That's a great question. I would be super keen to, you know, see some data on that. I think we've seen just kind of anecdotally across a pretty broad generational range of people being like, yes, this is exciting. A lot of feedback we've gotten is, I can't believe this didn't exist. And then I submit to anyone who's attempted to organize a bunch of queers, you probably figure out why it hasn't existed. Yeah, I think it, we've had questions from people about, can I come? I'm straight. And I think that's kind of an interesting one to think about. Cause I don't know that you would ask, are you allowed to go to the ballet if you're gay? You know, are you allowed to go to art that is either explicitly or just implied to be heterosexual? Yeah, I think there's definitely some people who are kind of like, oh, queer. Oh, I still feel weird about using that. But I think, that's kind of the beauty of the community and having conversations about it, is we all get to sort of decide what we want to do. And yeah, it's just a fun word, honestly. We didn't put as much, you know, in trying to name the thing, it was, we wanted something that really did what it said on the tin. You'd be really clear, this is a queer arts festival. And yeah, we didn't really want to go further than that, especially for the first time around where you're trying to explain what's a new festival, where did this come from? Yes, there's still a pandemic on, how are we dealing with that? And yeah, just decided to go with a really just not at all subtle name or branding.
It kind of does hark back to, this year is the 50th anniversary of Gaylib in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. There were things before 1972, but it really took off in 1972, and it was really blatant. And I think words like queer, it is completely blatant, and it is what it is. Yeah. It is what it says it is. One of the other things that happened in 1972, that they used performance as a way of getting across political or social messages. Mm. Do you think that still happens with queer performance today, that it's all about kind of social messaging, political messages?
Yeah, I think most art is about kind of reflecting on society and our place in it and how you feel about it, whether it's queer or not. But I think it's interesting in a lot of queer art forms, just existing visibly queer, is still a political statement, especially if you are going to deviate from the gender binary in any way, or if you're going to kind of mess with any of those sort of norms around what does it mean to be gay or lesbian or to be, any particular narrow branch of identity. I think one thing that we talked about a lot in kind of starting this festival, and a loose theme of the festival, has been specifically around queer joy. And I've been pondering a lot lately about the idea of kind of joy as an act of resistance, and joy as a political act as well. There's a lot of queer narratives tend to be rooted in trauma, because there are traumatic experiences, but there's also really beautiful, happy, joyous ones. And I think it's important that we celebrate those, and we celebrate those in ways that honor that is also important art, that is serious and deep and meaningful and poignant. And I think there's this thing across all the arts where, comedies don't win Oscars. It's drama that's real art, and it's serious. And I don't think that's true. I think that you can make just as much of a political statement with joy as you can with any other emotion. And so I guess that's a long way of saying that, yes, any art can be political. Existing as a queer person can be a political act. And sometimes it can just be fun and silly. But I think one thing that I've enjoyed in just recent years in kind of Wellington's art scene, this is just me personally, is how much drag has kind of gone from playing at the binary to just, overt gender fuckery across the board. And I really have enjoyed that, and the way of just kind of pushing back against all of the norms we hold around genders. Just obliterating them in a way that's really fun to watch and really interesting to get people kind of thinking about, why does this make me uncomfortable? Why does this make me feel alive inside? I think it's good to have space for political art, for joyous art, for all of the things.
Just picking up on the kind of theme of joy and fun. I have a feeling that over 2 years of COVID pandemic, we're all looking for a bit more, fun and joy. And I'm wondering, how has COVID-19 impacted on creating a festival, getting performances going, and also getting audiences in?
It's hard. it's been hard for the arts for 2 years because, when there has been funding to support, sometimes it's difficult to access. It can be difficult to access for individual performers. Initial funding was kind of channeled through employers, which makes it really difficult if you're a sole contractor and if you're kind of doing art on the side. So it's been hard to make art and to be a performer. Whether that's because shows got canceled, whether that's because distancing meant that you'd either have to quadruple ticket prices or just have really sad small shows. And so there's been a lot of factors that have made it just really difficult to do art. And I think we're still in the throes of a pandemic, but we're kind of changing the way we relate to it. It makes event planning challenging. One thing that was kind of nice about the festival is by coming together as kind of a group of us, we're able to share some of the organizing around, printing posters and having kind of larger scale marketing and doing things as a festival rather than individual events, to try to kind of, by having a bunch of producers putting on things, hopefully getting a little bit more cross-pollination across different communities. But it's hard. I think people are definitely, venturing back out, but many people are not, and that's very understandable. We're also seeing that people are definitely not booking tickets in advance. A lot of people are kind of waiting to the day of, which is great for them, is stressful for people who manage budgets. but I think it's very true, is that we're kind of deciding what does the world look like in a a reality where the pandemic is just part of our life now, and how do we navigate that? And it makes events hard, it makes festivals hard, but it also makes an event happening really exciting and magical. Cause there've been so many cancellations, and there've been so many, even just somebody getting sick and having to be swapped out. And it's just like, it really impacts if you, you know, if you make your life in live art, and I don't make my living in live art, but if you do that, it's really, the pandemic has sucked. And so that's part of what we want to do, is just have a chance to be like, yes, you know, get back out, perform something, get in front of an audience again. Audiences, have some joy in your life. Hopefully we can keep having more of it.
Yay. Well, thinking about the future and thinking about year two of this festival, what are your thoughts? And do you think there will be a festival next year?
I love this. Everyone, I mean, people asked this before this festival even started. And I was like, let's see how the first one goes. Let's see if everyone survives. But yes, we'd love to. This was fun. Festivals are great. Celebrating queer art is great. June this year was kind of an accident. So one of the shows in the festival, Too Much Hair, the other co-founder and I, they're creating that show, and that show had a season booked at BATS for last week of May, first week of June. And so we were like, let's do a queer arts festival. Who knows what's going to work out? We'll see. We'll have Too Much Hair on. Maybe we get a couple other events. If we can get two or three in, we can call it a festival, and we can call our first year a success if we have like multiple events. And then everyone got really excited, and like venues out of nowhere were contacting us to be like, hello, we would like to be involved. Would you like a free space? Here's some money. Here's some product. And the festival got larger, which is great. And so we liked, I mean, June was nice because yes, it aligns with Pride. It aligned with the show. It was kind of, it felt like a ridiculous, but not completely unreasonable amount of time to try to put something together. It was in fact ridiculous, but here we are. And so, yeah, we're thinking about what the future would look like, another festival. June is nice for Pride. June is not nice for Wellington. It's really hard to want to come to an 8 or 9 o'clock event if it's been dark for 4 hours, and if it's been raining. So, yeah, the timing could change. But the nice thing about like planning in advance, it would be nice to like book out with as many venues as we could, to have had enough planning time, because part of the challenge of doing this with 2 or 3 months notice is you're kind of limited by either venues that don't book that far in advance or have empty space or like kind of filling in gaps. And so that meant we had some events on sort of what are weird nights for their sector, like Tuesday night comedy, not super common. And so being able to kind of plan ahead with more venues and, plan bigger lineups and, you know, go to print with a paper program in advance, because we would have confirmed lineups with more advance notice. So yes, currently it would be nice if there would be another one. Some of that depends on funding and getting other funders to come to the table, particularly if we want to kind of expand it and cover more things. And that's that tension of keeping a festival viable for performers and affordable for audiences, which is a bigger conversation that I think we need to have as an art sector in a city about how we price tickets. But that's a different conversation. So yes, there will likely be one, perhaps at a more hospitable time of year. But also, I mean, I guess not trying to find a kind of a time of year when there isn't something else on or something else huge, but trying to fill in the gaps of the year. So we'll see. Stay tuned.
We're just about a day and a half away from the end of the festival. What are your biggest takeaways from organizing this time?
Queer artists are great. Like, it's a delight to work with a whole bunch of people who are kind of sharing the same values and are excited about the same things and who believe that art is important and that it's not a luxury, but it's something that makes our lives and our cities more beautiful and worthwhile. So that's great. I think it's been really exciting to see the number of people and businesses who came to us wanting to get involved. I've organized other events where either things like getting sponsorship or trying to find spaces can feel like pulling teeth, or it feels like you're really struggling to get this happening. And we had people literally calling us up out of nowhere to be like, hello, we would like to be involved. How can we help? Which has been really incredible, which kind of shows that there are a lot of people who care about art and artists in this town, even when it kind of feels like the systems don't. Yeah. So that's been exciting. And just to see kind of audiences and like groups of artists, like that, that magic that comes together during a show or during an event, is just really nice. And these, we had a poet at one of the events the other night who said that it was their first time reading at an explicitly queer event, which struck me as really interesting, particularly for poetry. But yeah, that, that place where you kind of, in spaces that sort of start out from that assumption, you get to have more interesting connections and conversations with people because you start from just more shared understanding, I guess. I don't know. It's just, it's really lovely and wholesome to see queer artists performing and having a good time and see audiences having a nice time. And honestly, I'm really looking forward to next week when I get to pay everyone and just like sit down for 4 hours. Just like, you get money and you get money and you get money to 70 something artists, which is kind of why we did this. And it's really exciting to, actually get to do that.
That's amazing. And thank you so much for putting on the festival and giving people the space to perform and show their works.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, thanks to people for coming and for people for making beautiful art so that we have something to share. Yeah, I guess if you want to be involved in future ones, slide into our DMs or inbox. We'll see. I don't know. Yeah. Thank you.
Now, sharing this wonderful hub as well, we've got Lagans, and I'm just going to go over and have a chat with the team at Lagans. So
right. luckily
it's a small space, because otherwise I'd be padding for a long time. And we have from Lagans, who do we have from Lagans today?
Will Hansen from Lagans.
And Roger Smith from Lagans.
So, Will and Roger, why was it important for Lagans to be here today?
Well, it's great to show support for the Queer Arts Festival, and it's a great opportunity for us to advertise what we do in front of a fairly sympathetic crowd, and just to show some of the artefacts that we have. I'm looking at the table for inspiration, so some copies of some of the artefacts and things that we have in the archive, a little bit of a PowerPoint presentation, which people can sort of browse through and see the sort of work that we do and sorts of things that we collect and things that we would like to have more of if people have in their attics or photos or whatever. And really just a chance to get ourselves in front of the community. That's why it's important for us to be here today.
So let's go to the table. And Will, can you just take me through some of the stuff that you've brought today?
Oh, yeah. So I've bought three different zines. We've got the zine that's just a free zine about Lagans that people can just pick up and take away. And then there's the two volumes of the Archive is Alive zines. Oh, and then I've got two stickers that say smile if you're trans. They were the only ones I had left.
And what about on the rest of the table?
And then on the rest of the table, what is this that we have here? Is this just...
So these are copies of some of the things we have in the archive. So there are pages from various queer magazines or news papers or letters that have been published in New Zealand over the years. What else? We've got some great photos of various protests and demonstrations around the place.
And also on the table, there's a book called 20 Years On, and that was looking at homosexual law reform, I think. Was it 2006, 2005?
That's right. Yes, correct. That's right. So it was put together by Alison Laurie and Linda Evans. And there was a conference and an exhibition held around that time as well. And this book is of some of the papers that were given by such people as Tim Barnett, Marion Street was talking, Tony Simpson, Phil Parkinson, Tiggy and Stone, Miriam Safira. So a lot of the big names in the community were giving papers at that conference, and it's great that they've been collected together in this booklet, which is available for sale.
So I was talking to Jess before, and we're just mentioning about 1972 being the 50th anniversary of gay liberation, and so we've got homosexual law reform 86, but back in 72, that's when gay liberation was just starting. Well, I know you've written quite a bit around about gay liberation in the 1970s. What is it like for you to kind of reflect back on the 1970s? Because you're still quite young, aren't you? I mean,
I'm 25. So reflecting back on the 70s for me, well, I guess for me it's just feeling So grateful looking at what people have done and how hard people worked and what they put on the line to change things, and feeling hopeful and wanting to continue on that legacy and wanting to find ways to emulate what they did back then and what we can learn, and all of those kinds of things is what I think of. But I also think about the difference, what it was like to be a student back then versus what it's like to be a student now, and the kinds of different challenges we face too. Is that a good thing?
I just wonder, when I look back at the 70s, it's just such another country, isn't it, New Zealand? And, what would have gay liberation been like, say, with social media, with smartphones, with the way that we're all so interconnected nowadays?
I think it would be ruined by infographics. I don't know. That's a really interesting question.
I don't know. I think ease of getting messages out more quickly. I think rather than it being kind of a secret society, it would have been much more sort of public. Certainly as a way of sort of rallying people for the cause. Social media is great. It would have been totally different, I think. And maybe it wouldn't have taken then another 10, 14, 15 years for law reform. It might have actually, the mood might have been, tidal wave might have been such that things might have happened a lot more quickly.
Well, thank goodness for Lagans and actually saving the images and documents and pamphlets and meeting notes from that time, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel very grateful for Lagans, and I think maybe I've said this to you before, but when I was still in the closet and still at high school, when I was Googling gay history things, it was Lagans that was coming up. So, it definitely feels very personal for me to be able to actually hold these materials, and I hope that people who are coming in off the street have that same kind of feeling of community and of family and heritage when they see these things.
And is Lagans, am I right in thinking Lagans is celebrating a special year this year?
It is. Sorry, Will. So 30 years in its current incarnation as Lagans. So that it's a charitable trust now, and that's been going 30 years. But it's also 45 years since it was kind of formed, and things were started to be collected together, which eventually became Lagans. So that's another celebration that we are going to be marking this year in September with an evening of things about rainbow history that will involve Lagans and some speakers from the past.
Actually, that's the cool thing about some of the stuff that we have here is this is stuff that people were collecting even before there was the resource center. So even before the 45 years, there's people's scrapbooks and things, and honoring that long legacy is a really cool thing to be able to do with some of the material here.
And Will, you're quite heavily involved in that September event.
Yeah, I was definitely involved in the start of thinking about it. I came up with the title Out of the Ashes because I didn't come up with it, but it was already on the Lagans website, Chris Parkin and Phil Parkinson, wrote that title and wrote a piece about Lagans history. And so I thought calling the event that is a nice way to link to the work that they've done. And it's so dynamic. They did a really good job coming up with something so flashy about a phoenix rising out of the ashes and in connection to Lagans, the arson attack on Lagans a few months after homosexual law reform in 1986. We want to honor that history, honor the resilience of the archives, all of those good things.
Thinking about the history of Lagans, what are the biggest challenges facing Lagans now?
I think money's a big one. Am I fair to say that? That I think, we just need more resources.
There are some ambitious plans in place for digitising the collection and making it more accessible digitally. And so that's a big expense, getting the website, getting the databases, getting the digitalisation programme happening. So that's thing one. But thing two, it's curated and looked after by a really small team, a small board, and then within that we've got the curators, Linda Evans and Roger Swanson, who do the sort of hands-on, acquisition of things and the describing and the cataloguing of of material as it comes into the archive. But what we really need is somebody doing that on a, if not a full-time basis, at least a part-time basis, but on a permanent basis, preferably, so that we've got someone who's constantly looking at the collection and maintaining it and being the point of contact when people want to access the collection. And that's really important. But again, that's expensive hiring qualified, knowledgeable people in that area isn't cheap. I mean, nor should it be cheap, to be honest, but it's an expense, so we've got to raise money for that kind of thing too. And it's an ongoing cost as well, because we want someone looking after it all the time, not just coming in for a couple of months and then going away and then coming back. You know, we need somebody there who is that point of contact all the time.
And that links into, I guess those are our practical concerns and challenges, but then that links into our more abstract, I guess, goals and our about accessibility and about inclusion and about that's why events like this are so important, because that allows us in a way that we don't have to spend much money to actually come in and look at the archive. But digitization will be a huge way of making things more accessible for people and bringing things out to people, so they don't have to come all the way into Wellington, into the National Library, and do all that kind of intimidating stuff that can be intimidating for people.
In my sense has been that over the last, 5-10 years, there has been a real increase in not just young people, but a lot of queer communities really interested in the past and wanting to make use of things like LAGANs. Have you found that as well, that the actual access requirements are kind of going up?
I think certainly interest in the archive and what it has to offer is going up. I know from the reports that Roger and Linda do at the board meetings on people that have sent in queries or have wanted to visit the archive or wanted to use it, has definitely gone up. More and more people are doing their PhD research using, using material from the archive. So definitely it's increasing over time. But to me, the very existence of the archive, of LAGANs as an archive for lesbian and gay and all the other parts of the alphabet soup, is really significant and important, because it raises the question, why do we need this archive? And the answer to that question is because for most of our history, no one has been collecting this material. We couldn't rely on a public library or the National Archive to collect material which related to our history. And that's outrageous when you think about it, because our history is the nation's history, is the world's history. So the fact that this exists because no one else was collecting it, somebody had to, is, for me, it's a real reminder of the fact that so much of our history is hidden or hasn't been preserved or is forgotten, and the existence of an archive is a way of trying to reopen those doors, to remind ourselves of our history, to assert that we have a history that needs to be explored and researched and talked about and celebrated.
It was interesting you talking about, specifically about kind of lesbian and gays and everyone else, and I note that the LAGANs name is Lesbian and Gay Archives. I mean, is that just from a time and a place when LAGANs was formed? Because, I mean, it seems a bit narrow now, and I guess, does it mean that other voices aren't heard in the archive?
Well, I think it's a really interesting question, because I definitely found that when I first joined LAGANs, I remember beginning to reach out to other trans people and them rejecting me, asking them to donate things or to buy things to put in the archive, because they didn't feel represented by the name, and they're used to organizations that do have limiting names not making space for them. And I think, I guess in terms of thinking about it as a time and a place, I don't want to be too harsh, especially because I wasn't there, I don't know, but I feel like we did have trans stuff in the collection, and it wasn't a good thing that it was, you know, named such a limiting thing, even if it was also just what people were doing at the time. So I think it's a really important thing that we look at, because it's not just a name, it's about making a statement of who we're here for. And that reminds me of like what Roger was saying just before about the importance of our archives, and actually like the fact that denial of our history is used to oppress us, and is used by TERFs and transphobes and queerphobes of all different kinds to try and undermine us and undermine our right to life and our struggles and all of those kinds of things. And I do think that we are seeing a rise in anti-trans rhetoric, and I think broader anti-queer rhetoric too. Looking at what's going on in the States right now is really scary, but that's also kind of stuff happening here. So I think that our archive is, you know, this information, it's so important that it be kept safe, and it's so important that it be kept in community hands. I think that's where the name, it's all part of that. It's all standing up and saying, we're here and we have a history and we've always been here and all of that kind of thing.
And it absolutely starts from the very top of it, from that name, doesn't it? And kind of comes down from that.
So we definitely, in saying all that, we definitely have some beautiful collections that are not just lesbian and gay collections. And just looking here at a letter written by Sandy Gauntlet, who was a absolutely incredible trans activist and who was involved in, set up the Rotorua Gay Liberation Front and all of those kinds of things and all of those histories that, you know, me being a researcher as well, I wouldn't be able to access any of that information if it wasn't for Lagans and the same people who made the name Lagans. So, you know, I can't be too mean about it.
and I guess it's also not to diminish, lesbian and gay archives as well. And it must be a very hard thing when you've got an organisation that's been around for a long time to actually kind of move as our ideas about identity and the words we use changes over time, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And so, yeah, I definitely don't mean it in a mean way, because I do think, I can't articulate it as well as you just did, but I agree with you.
But also, having said that, and I don't mean to finish your sentence, Will, but definitely it's, you know, it needs to change. You know, the time for a change of the title describing what it is that we are and what we do is well and truly here. In fact, it's probably past. But it's not a problem which is exclusive to New Zealand, and other archives around the world have also risen to the challenge of finding a name which is inclusive of all the people that we represent. So that challenge is certainly definitely on for us here in New Zealand, and some suggestions about a change in the name would actually be really useful. If people have any, then let us know.
Well, this is a really lovely segue into the kind of international space, and I know, Roger, that you are one of the founding members of a very special group.
Yeah, so the group, I have to read it because it's it took us quite a bit of time in the very first meeting that we had, a Zoom meeting at the beginning of the year, to agree, try to get an international group of people to agree on anything, but to agree on the name, what we were going to be called, and then agree on what it was that we were going to be doing. You'd think it's almost the impossible, but actually we achieved it. And so the name, the official name, is it's the International Committee on LGBTQ Plus History Months. The mission statement is, I'll just quickly get through this too, the mission of the International Committee on LGBTQ Plus History Months is to share knowledge, to support existing LGBTQ Plus History Month projects, and to encourage new LGBTQ Plus History Months around the world. And so this starts from an idea that a guy called Rodney Wilson in the US had, and that was to have a whole month celebrated nationally, not just in your city or your state, but the whole of the US, looking at queer history, devoted to queer history, and for it to be an annual event. And since 1994, he's achieved that. There's been a month devoted every year to queer history. Fantastic. And so his mission was to try and recruit as many other countries around the world to have national months of celebration for queer history. And so far, there are the likes of the UK, which has had one every year since 2005. Some of the constituent parts of the UK have their own history months, like Northern Ireland and Scotland and Wales have their own history months as well, annually, and they have since the mid-2000s. And then there are other countries too, like Australia has had one since 2016, Canada, Finland, Italy, and kind of what I find surprising is places like Hungary have had every year since 2013 have had a month celebrated nationally to explore and to you know, promote queer history. Now, I find it extraordinary about Hungary when you think of the political situation there. It has a very right-leaning government, and they've introduced a number of homophobic rules and regulations, which make it very hard if you're a member of the rainbow community over there to exist, let alone enjoy life. And yet every year they've had this month, and they had one, I think it was April this year, under really difficult circumstances, and yet it was really inspirational because they did it. And in fact, at the end of the month, instead of having a big end of year function celebrating the fact that they had their History Month, they decided to do a mass protest about the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and so they devoted that part of the History Month to some political activism on behalf of other people elsewhere, which is kind of amazing, really. So, so that sort of thing is really inspiring for me. And then, just this year, Cuba for the first time has had its first Rainbow History Month. And when you think of Cuba, again, they've got lots of human rights issues going on there, particularly for rainbow people. And yet they have managed to have a month devoted to looking at all sorts of aspects of rainbow history in Cuba. Fantastic. In fact, it was the first Rainbow History Month in a Spanish-speaking country, which is extraordinary. So they got there even ahead of Spain. Spain doesn't have one yet. And so I'm thinking, well, if these countries where actually life as someone, a part of the rainbow community, can be really hard, if they can have a whole month publicly acknowledging and celebrating and promoting rainbow history in their country, well, why can't we? And we've had a few kind of fledgling attempts, and we do have lots of pride events around the country, but it's not quite the same as having a month devoted to queer history, which would be amazing if we could get off the ground in New Zealand maybe sometime next year. Have a forum for people who are doing academic research like Will, but also have exhibitions and things like this, displays and goodness knows what else, to promote rainbow history and the celebration of it in New Zealand. So if anyone is interested in doing that, get in touch with me through Lagans or someone else in Lagans, and we'll see what we can set up. Because I think that it's the more public we can be, the more publicly facing we can be and proud of our history, and really actively work to surface this history so that people can see it, I think the better.
It must be amazing to be in a group where, yes, there are shared experiences, but even the wording used to describe sexual and gender identities must be so different across all those different countries, and the kind of legal and political landscape must be so different, and the kind of events that people are putting on must be so different as well. Must be quite quite invigorating, yeah?
It is invigorating and really inspiring, really inspiring, and I'm extremely grateful that all the meetings, the board meetings that we have, are conducted in English. But when you consider that most of the members are from countries that do not speak English as a first language, I feel incredibly privileged, in a very privileged position to just sit back and think, oh, this is, I can understand every word that, whereas other people are managing and succeeding brilliantly to articulate, you know, all sorts of things in a language which isn't their first language. And it makes me think, oh, you know, I've got English and a little bit of German, but to have such fluency, you know.
We are now in the 50th anniversary year of gay liberation in New Zealand. I'm wondering, just as a final wrap-up question, where do you see us being in 50 years' time in terms of rainbow queer communities?
I hope by then we don't have, capitalism is abolished by then. That's my hope. And then I see a much brighter, I hope that some kind of indigenous-led revolution decolonized New Zealand, no longer New Zealand, Aotearoa. I don't know what that means, me being Pākehā, but I'm just willing to follow the lead and be a foot soldier and whatever that looks like. So that's what I'm hoping happens, something big like that.
I think Will summed it up perfectly. I don't know how I can add to that. Except that I would hope that in 50 years' time, queer history, rainbow history, trans history is acknowledged and is celebrated and is out there as white colonial history is. Really? I think that if we can achieve that in 50 years' time, then awesome.
It's maybe more realistic than my one.
And the last word, I'm going to go back to Jess, because Jess has actually brought all of us together today with the Queer Arts Festival. Jess, in 50 years' time, where do you think rainbow queer communities are going to be?
I'm just going to echo Will's call for revolution. That sounds great. Sign me up for that.
Nice.
I mean, I just like to be a nice, elder queer, marveling at the kids these days and how great they're doing.